It was 1969 and the Ardoin Kickhams from Belfast won the Under-16 Football Championship in South Antrim. That team is regarded as one of the best Under-16 sides that Ardoin has ever produced. Pat Murphy was the team's goalkeeper in the 69 final. What follows is his story of the players and their families in the 20 troublesome years since. It's a story based on a faded squad photograph of the 24 boys who won the championship in August 1969.
It was the 23rd of August 1969, smashing day, sun was splitting the stones. We played St. Gall's at the first part of our double we were going for, the championship and league, it was the championship final. We won it 9-4, played very, very well, and we eventually lost out in the double. We were beaten in a playoff for the league, but it was the best underage squad that the club had seen in a long time, and there was very, very big things expected of it, you know, at that stage of the game, you know. It was the first team photograph I remember been in or been part of the team, you know, having the photograph taken. It was great gas immediately before the final, very professional, lined up and got the photograph taken and then played the final. It was a Saturday, exactly 7 days after the Brits had come in. And the club had got a minibus from somewhere and drove us from Ardoin over to Casement Park where the match was, and moved through the falls, and which was still practically smouldering, mills and barricades and burnt out buses and motor cars. And it never really fizzed on us. The most important thing that day was to play the match and win, do well. And it was a period of time before it really dawned on us as kids that it was a serious thing. You know, the ratting was a bit of crack and the beast bicycles, the paddle bomb, and then it suddenly began to dawn on you sort of that there was actually people had been killed and that people were made homeless, and it wasn't a game or it wasn't good fun, it was deadly serious. Then you got the trickle of the lads started towards emigrating away from the place. Tommy Ferguson and a couple of them went initially, and then in particular friends of mine, Davy and Danny Watson, went. They were actually in the team photo that day, on the team. Davy was captain of the team, and Davy was a particular friend of mine. We played Minor County Vocational Schools football together and knocked about for an awful long time together. I remember him leaving well. I never actually got the boat that night, though. A lot of the boys went down along with his family. I rang him. I was chasing a young girl up the Falls Road at the time and didn't make it down to the boat, but I remember Davy leaving well. You know, it was terrible. You know, the thought that your old buddy Davy Watson, well, he wasn't that old, he was only 18 at the time, but your old buddy Davy Watson was going halfway around the world and you probably wouldn't see him again.
Davy Watson's departure from Belfast was sponsored by a group known as the British Boys Movement. Davy had played midfield for the team and he emigrated to Australia from Belfast Harbour.
Well, my father came down with some of my brothers and sisters. My mother, unfortunately, wasn't able to make it. She just felt that she couldn't say cheerio at the boat. She just said it in the house. I think it just was too much for her. The thought that our family was fine. I mean, I was the first of the family to go. Should have been married or out or anywhere. And I think it just was too much for her.
And what was it like as a teenager arriving suddenly in Australia? It's a long way away.
It was daunting. Suddenly realising that you're in the place where you had always wanted to go to, but you were soon brought back to reality when you went to the hostel, and it was run in a regimented fashion, and you soon thought to yourself, you thought maybe you joined the army instead.
What sort of jobs did you end up getting?
The first job that I got was as a ticket clerk in the railway system out there. They use it the same as in England to have the underground system, so it is quite busy, and it is a very demanding job.
Were you making a break of it as a ticket clerk?
I thought I was doing well until one morning, as I was selling the tickets, someone came up and asked for a return to Burwood, and I told him the price. I said, "Idiot." And they just stood back in amazement, and they didn't say anything. And the two of us were both looking at each other, and there was a gentleman behind me who was watching my progress, because I was only a trainee, who then pulled me to one side, and he said, "What did you say to that person?" And I says, "Idiot." He said, "Oh," he says, They think you've called them an idiot.
You meant, of course, 88p.
I meant, of course, 88 cents.
Or 88 cents.
So I decided, well, I seem to be having a little bit of trouble with the language difficulties here, so maybe I'll try something else.
What other jobs did you move along to when you were out there?
I moved into labouring. Done it mostly in the winter. In the winter when it just wasn't quite as warm. During the summer, I used to get jobs in clerical capacity.
You lasted how long?
2.5 years.
But about a quarter of that team of 1969 are still away, and some indeed in Australia. They just haven't come back.
Yes, there are quite a few who have gone and haven't returned. I think that a lot of them felt that, okay, the coverage maybe had a different effect on me. I felt that I wanted to be there, but a lot of them felt that possibly, well, where I am, I'm safer, I've got a better life, and I think I'll just stay.
And never came back.
And they never came back.
I think that over the next 4 or 5 years, you lost a lot of players. You had good players, Liam Carr, Big Mossy, Roy Carrigan, Martin Mullen, a lot of them all away and not living in the district or country anymore. At the same time, you also had the harassment by the security forces in the nationalist area. There initially had been a delay where, and then the Brits discovered there was a difference between soccer and Gaelic football, and that we were in fact going to play a nationalist game or a national Irish game. The club had acquired its own minibus by this stage, and once it became known to the soldiers that were in the area, it was always asserted to be stopped, and you were taken out and names taken, frisked, and just sort of general harassment. And while the immigration went ahead, the sectarian assassination campaign was going on apace, and there was a lot of members bereaved. And well, Raymond Mooney, for example, who was the right back on that team of 69, was assassinated. Raymond and his brother Gabriel knocked about the club together, and you know, you remember them from matches and playing hurling and football and going away on holiday outings. And well, Raymond's not there anymore. Raymond's dead, and well, Gabriel still is, and he's bearing the memories of the assassination and all it meant to his family.
Raymond Mooney, the right back for Ardoyne, was murdered in the grounds of the Holy Cross Chapel on the Crumlin Road after attending a religious meeting. His brother Gabriel remembers.
Well, apparently he had been at the Living Church meeting. He actually chaired a Living Church meeting. And he had been starting off a new season, as I would call it. And he was putting the whole aspect of the Living Church to two new priests. One of them was the new rector, had just arrived a couple of days. And they were leaving then after the meeting. Everybody else had gone except for him and the lady was with him and another boy who was still in the hall. And from what I can gather, from what I've been told and reports I've heard, that when they came out, they go into a sort of a yard and then go into an outer door, and they locked the doors after them. And they were coming out onto the bank when these three boys jumped out at them, and one of them had a gun, and I don't think the other two were armed at all. And they run them from one end of the grounds to the far end of the grounds, and in the process they were asking questions like, was there anybody in the hall? And Raymond said no, there was nobody else in the hall. They were saying, do you know why we're doing this? We're the Protestant Action Force. We've just lost a good friend. Do you know why we're doing this? And apparently, according to the lady who was with him, at one stage, the two boys who hadn't been armed were saying that they were sorry that this had to be done. They were sorry it had to be done. Then they proceeded to kneel them both down and ask Raymond for identification. And then they just took the lady away to, not too far away, I suppose about 20 feet, and tied her up. And then apparently they shot him. 4 or 5 times, whatever it was.
There was no real reason why it should have been Raymond. He wasn't involved in anything, was he?
The only thing he was involved with was the church. Which is, I mean, if he hadn't been where he was, as I keep saying, if he hadn't been as good a Christian as he was, he wouldn't have been there. It wouldn't have been him. But then, anybody in the grounds that night who would have been there for their faith, whether it be Protestant, Catholic, they were there because of their faith. Anybody would have been killed because of their faith, whoever was in the ground that night. It just happens that it was Raymond.
It must have had terrible effects as well on his wife and children.
Yeah, very bad effect on his wife and his children. His children, like, even to this day, only coming around to the fact that, you know, their daddy's not coming back. Going to the graveyard, like, with the children I took Bridge up the first Sunday that after he was buried, and she took it very bad. Still does. We all do, even when I go up. But his children are coming out with things like, so by the time my daddy was up and got home with us, and like the young fella, he went and got a piece of metal somewhere in the graveyard and decided he was going to dig his daddy up. And the wee girl says, well, I'm going to climb up to heaven and bring him home. Oh God, heartbreaking things like that. Some of the things that come off us was unbelievable.
Yeah. And the effects on your family must have been terrible as well.
Well, the mother and brother and father, like, the mother will never be the same. Brother, father, I mean, they've been through it before in a way, like, but...
In what sense? What do you mean?
This is with the older brother. He's 10 years missing this year. I mean, it's been unheard of him. So, I mean, it was just like all that. I remember that night, just even done, I feel I'd done the same things. I cried the same way. I thought the same things then. Only we know where Raymond is now. We know, we don't know where Patrick is. I don't know if, I know I'll never get over it. I don't want to ever get over it. I don't want to ever let it go. The fact that he's dead.
What sort of feeling do you have about the whole event now?
Bitterness, I don't know. At the time I said it, I didn't feel bitter. I feel bitter up to a stage that we can't get peace in this country, that nobody will talk to each other, that the politicians won't talk to each other. I don't feel bitter really about the people who did it, because they have to live with it. I feel the man who pulled the trigger will live with it. And I tell you, he has got some living to do. I believe in my heart that the two men that was with him, who said they were sorry, up to the extent don't mean they were sorry, but they do as well. And I've got a feeling them men are going to break down. Because the way I feel it, them two men are going to break down. And the fella who shot him, God will take his own revenge on the man who shot him. And we have, my family, my close family here, have prayed for him. And prayed for the other two. And I've prayed to Raymond, in a way, to help us to control ourselves. To help me to control myself about the way I feel about people in this country. In the north of Ireland. I just don't relate to anybody in the north of Ireland at the minute.
I think assassinations like that hit people particularly hard. If you take our down as a very close-knit district, as it is, you would know the majority of people in it to see. And then you take within that larger framework of the district, the club, which is a very tight nucleus. And you would either know people in it from you were 8 or 9 and joined the club, or you would see people joining after you at the age of 8 or 9 and see them growing up. You know, for example, in the 69 team, there was Michael and Frank McCallum, who were about the third or fourth generation of the McCallum family to play for Ardoyn GAC, and their younger brother Colum, who came after them and went through the same process, played up through the age groups, under 12, under 14 on up. Colum was assassinated in his early 20s, and the pain, you know, of knowing someone like that and having seen them almost grow up along with them, see them killed wastefully like that is very painful, and to see friends of yours like Michael McCallum suffering because of that event is very bad.
The UVF claimed responsibility for the death of Colum McCallum. He was a technical student, just married, and he was shot at Ligonil, where he lived. His brother Michael was a forward on the team of 69.
Colum had been at home. He had a number of drawings to finish off for a course he was doing at college, and he had left the house to come out and have a smoke or take a breath of air or something and get away from the drawings. He was only wearing a light t-shirt and a pair of goodies, and
He seems to just to have walked it into these fellas. They chased him. One witness stated that one of the men had tried to catch hold of Colm, and Colm had hit him. As he ran away, there were shots fired after him, and one of them hit him, and he fell. The three men then ran towards Colm and shot him again. At one stage, their gun had jammed, and they'd cleared the gun and shot him again in the head. Then that was it. They'd left him for dead and took themselves off.
He didn't die immediately, did he?
No, he didn't. A lady who lived nearby had heard the shots, and she testified later that up to 3/4 of an hour later, she had heard Colm groaning, and she unfortunately was too terrified to come out of the house herself. But it became apparent, you know, from at the inquest that Colm had crawled maybe the best part of 100 yards on his arms following the shooting. He wasn't able to get up. And one fellow and his girlfriend, who had came across these men earlier themselves, they had come across Colm again, and at first they were reluctant to go near the Colm in case it was they were going to be led into something themselves. And the girl started to recite an act of contrition in Colm's ear. At that stage, Colm told her, "Look, stop, I'm not that bad," and had tried to get up again.
Do we know why Colm was picked as a target?
I don't think that Colm was actually selected in that kind of a sense. I think Colm was what's termed here a random victim. These people had been in Ligonier Estate for some period before Colm got shot, and had chased and tried to get hold of a couple of other people earlier. One man was walking a couple of greyhounds, and he had come upon them, and they chased him. A young fellow and his girlfriend had walked into them earlier on and managed to get away from them. So, I mean, in Colm's situation, I think he just happened to be the unlucky one who fell into them.
He lived for a couple of days, didn't he?
That's right. He lived a couple of days after he was taken to the intensive care unit in the Royal Victoria, and he was placed in a life support machine. And it was a couple of days later that, you know, they pronounced him dead. Certainly, you know, when I saw him that morning after being shot, I didn't hold out any hope at all for him to have lived. And I'd actually went up to Ligonier and had a look where he'd been shot, and quite literally they had blown the brains out of him. And you know, I don't think myself nor any of the rest of the family had any great hope that he was going to come through, or great belief that he was going to come through.
He died on the 14th of July.
Yeah, that's right. He died in the afternoon of the 14th.
As time went by, you became, or you even imagined you became, sort of hardened to the troubles. There was a familiarity about them that maybe bred contempt to an extent. The first thing that struck me was that initially, when a gun battle occurred, there was shots fired in the area, that the women standing at their doors or the kids playing the street would have run into the house out of the road of the gunfire. And after 4 or 5 months, there was this curiosity about it. And when a gun battle or gunshots occurred, the people would have run out of the houses to see what had actually happened and where the incident had taken place. And you had the whole sort of blasé thing about it, you know. You had teams travelling in from the country to play in the town, and you'd been playing in a park adjacent to, say, the likes of the White Rock or Lennon down at Ballymurphy, somewhere like that, and a gun battle had maybe broke out while you were in the process of playing somebody from a hackle out the country. And the lads used to have this great wind-up where they would have shouted over to each other, letting on the new, well, what type of guns were being fired. You know, that's an Armalite, no, that's an SLR, you know. And this used to take the countrymen to the cleaners. Another one I remember, a fellow who played in the senior team, was Tommy McCauley, who had got off the bus coming from work and had been shot in the back by a loyalist assassination squad. And we turned out about 3 weeks after that, playing a country team. And Tommy was one of the top players on our senior team at that time. And there was a question, where's Tommy? Oh, he was shot there the other week, you know that, but he's okay, he's not dead, you know. And it was just sort of, you could see the difference between the country people and their attitude to it and our attitude to it, you know, which was harder. And then it hit home. Kieran, who was on that team with us, he was assassinated, shot dead when he was 17 years of age, and he was my brother, and it really brings it home to you then.
Kieran Murphy was a reserve on that 69 side. He was a trainee engineer, and on October the 13th, 1974, he was abducted by paramilitaries on the Cliftonville Road.
Well, the Chinese we just passed, is the one he went to that night with his friends, and he decided to walk on up this road here on his own. And he got to, as far as we were able to find out, he got to about this, round about this vicinity, and he was picked up. Must have showed him a bomb police car or something like that to get him into the car, because he was a big lump of a chap. And I don't think he would have went easily. They took him from here then on up the road that we're continuing along into one of the community centres, and they interrogated him there. And the inquest had come out, he had wounds in his chest and arm that were consistent with some puncture wounds, but you know, inflicted by a penknife. He'd been beaten, obviously. They then took him from the community centre in the Ballysillan, where they had him, on up to a place, a road called the Horseshoe Bend. On past it, there's a lot of old quarries, and he was shot in the quarry. What actually, as far as the police could put it together, he had slipped out of his coat, and there'd been a fair old fracas, and then he'd obviously made a run for it. They reckon the first bullet that hit him in the back of the leg as he was running away, and he then fell, obviously, sat up, turned around, put his hands up, bullet wounds in one of the hands and an exit hole at the elbow. He was hit 6 or 7 times, and probably the ironic thing about it is that there was only one of them actually fatal.
The Protestant Action Force claimed responsibility for it. What was the motive behind it?
Well, you know, I mean, you don't have to really look too far for a motive. Kieran was actually the third Catholic from the Ardoyne area that had been murdered in 4 days. It was Jimmy Hasty, another lad called Lutton, and Kieran was on the Saturday night. They, of course, came out with the usual bullshit that he was a member of the IRA and all the rest of it, but, I mean, it was just so much nonsense and smokescreen for them, you know.
You had to identify his body eventually.
Yeah, eventually the police took us from Musgrave Street round to the Leg and Bank Morgue, and which is a fairly horrible place. It's rather like the old municipal baths that you got built at the turn of the century. It's all tiles and terrazzo flooring. And when we entered the room where the bodies were, there was sort of 5 bodies along one wall that were toe-tagged, and they obviously knew who they were. There was 2 bodies then on the right-hand wall with no toe-tags on them, with sheets over them. And I looked at the nearest body to me, I could see Kieran, who had very curly hair. I could see the hair sticking out from under the sheet, and slept with him from as long as I can remember in the same room as him. I knew what his hair looked like sticking out under his sheet, and knew then, even before the policeman had pulled down the sheet to let me see him.
It's left an awful lot of bitterness with you.
Well, naturally, yeah, pain that sort of thing can be inflicted on families in Northern Ireland for no other reason than people imagine that they're a threat to them for whatever. It just, every time it happens, it brings it back to you, and you realise on both sides of the divide just what the families are suffering at the time, you know.
Well, after Kieran was assassinated, I continued to play for the club, but it got progressively harder to field and to play games. As a result of the troubles, we lost our home pitch, which was in a Protestant area, and we had no access to it because of the troubles. So we were travelling away to all your games, and, well, I must give ourselves a pat on the back. It was 1 year we won the award for never failing to field. It was tough, you know, by the late 70s, you're talking, there were 7 of the lads off that 69 team had immigrated to parts foreign. You had about 4 or 5 of them living in the south, and one of the boys dead. In fact, it was that bad generally in the district that the people raised a monument to all those people killed as a result of the Troubles. And it consisted of a large Celtic cross, which was a fellow called Donnie Carville picked up in his crane and brought up and set in place for the monument committee. About 3 weeks after that, Danny was shot dead travelling across the Shankill Road in his car. Danny was the brother of Brian Carville, who was the reserve goalkeeper in that under-16 team of 69. He's 14 years of age, same age as my own brother, Kieran. A good kid, another one that you'd seen grow up, and then all of a sudden, Brian was going through the same pain that so many other people in the district had gone through.
Danny Carville was just over 30 when he was gunned down. He was married, with the family. His brother Brian Carver was reserve goalkeeper for the 1969 Ardoyne Kickhams.
The night the brother was shot, you see, that day he went out for a drink to celebrate St Patrick's Day. And it was the first St Patrick's Day he had off for 10 years, so he was really going to enjoy himself, you know. Well, I came home from work, and the brother came up to me and said the sister had to be picked up from her work. So I offered to drive the car down to pick the sister up, but he wouldn't let me. So we had a bit of a fallout. That was at 5 to 6 that evening. Well, at 6:05, the police arrived at the door and informed me the brother had been shot.
What actually happened?
Well, as he was driving down to pick the sister up, he drove down Flag Street, and as crossing onto the Shankill Road down Canberra Street, a car followed him. And as he got to the bottom of Canberra Street, another car came up and hemmed him in. Now, he had his young lad with him at the time, his son, and seeing the gunman approaching, he threw his young lad down in the motor and threw him, his own body over his own son to shield him and protected him. Now, the gunman, he fired 4 shots into the brother, killed the brother, but thankfully the nephew was saved. He saved his own son by shielding him with his own body.
What was the reason for the murder, do you know?
Well, it was put down as purely sectarian. At the start, they tried to say he was in the wrong place at the wrong time, but they never proved any different, and you just have to take their word for it.
One of the people who actually committed the murder and was convicted for it eventually wrote to you, isn't that right?
Yeah, he did. After about 5 years of his conviction, he wrote to me asking could I come to see him in prison, because he wanted to apologise, and he had fallen in love with a police widow and he wanted to marry her. And he was really sorry for what he'd done, and was born again Christian, and he wanted to apologise personally. Now, but the police warned me not to go near him, because as far as they were concerned, he was a convicted liar, and he was trying to lie his way out of jail.
How do you feel about him?
Personally, I just don't want anything to do with him. No communication at all with him, because he already hurt our family once, and I would hate to think that he would get out and maybe hurt our family again, or hurt somebody else's family the same way as he hurted us.
How has the whole thing affected you throughout these past 11 years?
Well, after a few years, you tend to get used with it, because you have other friends that has been killed before the brother, and you have other friends that's been killed after the brother, and it seemed it gets to a way of life with you. But just as I was trying to get over it, I lost a wife through a cancer, and knowing her age was only 34, and the age of the brother then I thought was an old man of 33. Now I'm 33. I just realised how young he was and that he shot. And it really hurts me no more now than it did 11 years ago.
By the 1980s, there was only 3 of us left out of that photograph still playing for the club. Myself playing in goals, and Cam McAleer up around the forward line, and Mickey McCarvey, who played, still does play senior hurling for the club. You'd lost all sorts of players. You'd Raymond McClurg, moved away to Coventry. John McMahon, a senior hurler who was in the photograph, he was the manager of the team, he's living in England. Martin Mullen survived an assassination attempt, living in England. Liam Carr, father assassinated, family now lives down south. Jared Rosetta, father assassinated, emigrated to Canada. And it was no real way that you were going to build a club. Due to that, we'd dropped down from senior status, and it's very hard to sort of rebuild, to back up the senior status with that sort of thing happening. In that photograph, for example, there's 2 brothers, Liam Miller and Emmanuel, who the family moved away from the district. But their cousin, Sammy Morrison, he was at that game as a young kid, just joined the club and running about. Sammy became a senior footballer in the 80s. As I say, you're trying to build a team. The next thing, Sammy was hit in an attempted sectarian assassination and very badly injured. And Sammy will never play football again. So it makes it tough to try and get back up with that sort of thing happening.
Sammy Morrison was aged 30 when the attempted assassination took place. It happened at his home on Deer Park Road. It was a late night in November 87.
Well, I'd been in the Gaelic Club that evening for a few pints, and I got left around the house. It was about 8 o'clock. I was just in the door a few minutes when I heard a knock at the door, and I went out to open it. And the next thing I can remember is lying at the bottom of the stairs. I was in quite a bit of pain, and all I could see was blood everywhere. The mother came running out from the kitchen, and she was in an extremely hysterical state. She run out into the street, and a lot of neighbours come running in and started to phone for people. Her natural reaction, because she thought it was about that day, was to get a priest. However, I was more concerned about living, and I shouted at her to get a doctor, never mind a priest.
How many bullets had you been hit with?
I'd been shot 5 times, and once in the thumb, my left elbow, my right thigh, my stomach and my neck.
Do you know how many men were involved in the shooting?
No, I've no recollection at all of how many men were involved or the shooting itself. My mind is completely blank.
What do you think the reason was why they targeted you?
I've often thought about this now, and I don't actually think that I was picked specifically. I think it was just a random sectarian shooting. I don't think that was because I was a member of the Gaelic Club. They were just out to shoot a Catholic, and mine was the door that was picked.
And were the people responsible for the shooting ever found?
No, they were never caught, and it's highly unlikely that they will be.
What about the remnants, the effects of the injuries on you now for the rest of your life?
Well, the main injury is to my left elbow. It was shattered, so it means limited movement in my arm, so I'll not be able to play Gaelic football or hurling again.
Does it mean the end of your association with the club?
No. In fact, before I was shot, I was running the underage teams, and I have since returned to do so, and I will continue to do it.
What about your attitude now towards living in Ardoyne as a result of this shooting? Has it changed?
Well, before I was shot, I was living on the outskirts of the area. We've now moved into the middle of the area, so I obviously feel a lot safer going home from the club, or when you're sitting in the house at night, the same worry wouldn't be there as it would have been if I had been continued to live in the house I was living in.
Do you think about this an awful lot, what happened to you?
I try not to. However, when there are any incidents in the north, it always brings it back, and well, it'll always be in the back of my mind, I presume.
Do you feel in any way like a targeted man?
No, I don't feel as if I'm a target, because, as I said previously, I think it was a purely random sectarian shooting. So I've returned to work, and I've just tried to get on with my life, you know, as best I can, without thinking about what's happened.
Today, the Ardoyne Kickhams continue to field an under-16 team. All the players come from the parish of Ardoyne itself, but by general agreement, the team of 1988-89 is a poor reflection of that championship-winning side of 20 years ago.
If that team had stayed together, it's possibly hard to analyse just how well they would have done. But if you compare it, the club has won the under-16 football championship twice. They won it in 63. Now, the nucleus of that 63 team went on to lift the Division 1B Senior Football League title in, ironically enough, 1969. That 1969 team, if its nucleus had been kept together, it's quite possible that they would have emanated that feat and maybe captured the Senior League title. Certainly what we wouldn't have done was lose our senior status, because you've seen the drop from 69 to the 70s and 80s where we moved from senior right down to junior. And in a way, we've sort of clawed back to the intermediate level now, but as I say, you never know what that team might have achieved with some young players coming through, if not for the troubles and all things being equal. But however, that's all sort of water under the bridge now.
That's it, Sticky! Oh, beautiful!
Last summer in Belfast, Ardoyne Kickhams prepared for a new football season. They had failed to win the under-16 championship since 1969, and they had few hopes for the season ahead. But finally, the long-term prospects were looking brighter.
The strange thing, looking at the team sheets now in the club for the under-12 and under-14 level, is that the names are starting to recur again. Granted, we've lost a lot of guys through immigration and moving down south and moving away from the district, but the chaps that are still there, their kids are coming along, their sons are coming along and playing for the club. And in a couple of years' time, the under-16 football team is not going to look too dissimilar from the under-16 football team of 1969. You know, around like 20 years later, the team sheet's going to read McCallum and Murphy and Coleman and McCurvey. And that's, I suppose, part of the club, why the club was 80 years old last year, is that continuity and the continuation of playing the game and going for it, I suppose. It's a bit like surviving in Northern Ireland. You just get on with it. You take whatever shots is dealt at you and deal with it the best way you can and just continue on. And the under-16 team will be around for as long as the club's going to be around.
Ardoyne Kickham's under-16s, 1969. John McMahon, emigrated. Raymond Mooney, assassinated. Pierce Moss, emigrated. Liam Miller, lives in Belfast. Davy Wasson, emigrated but returned to Belfast. Raymond McClurg, emigrated. Pat Murphy, lives in Belfast, his brother assassinated. Roy Kerrigan, emigrated. Jim Murray, lives in Belfast. Leonard Cook, emigrated. Danny Wasson, emigrated. Michael McCurvey, lives in Belfast. Kieran Murphy, assassinated. Ronnie Harrison, lives in Belfast. Martin Mallon, emigrated. Gerard Rosato, emigrated but returned to Belfast. Paul Coleman lives in Belfast. Brian Carvel lives in Belfast, his brother assassinated. Michael McCallum and Frank McCallum both live in Belfast, their brother assassinated. Liam Corr emigrated, his father assassinated. Kevin McAleer lives in Belfast. Frank Mulgrave moved from Belfast. And lastly, Emmanuel Miller, still in Belfast.